Okay, I see people are still coming in, but just about to get started here. I want to say that I'm very happy to welcome Rabbi Alan Schwartz. He's giving a very special three-part series based on his new book, Conflict and Resolution in the Early Prophets. Tonight's topic will be Categories of Resolution in the Early Prophets. Rabbi Schwartz is the rabbi at Ohab Zedek in Manhattan. He's an alumnus of Yeshiva College and received his master's degree in Bible, Rabbinics, and Halakha from Yeshiva University's affiliated Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. He currently holds the Raymond J. Grimwald Chair in Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, where he's taught since 1983. We're very excited to have Rabbi Schwartz with us tonight. Sponsorship opportunities are available. If you're interested in sponsoring this program, please contact me or the Beth Aaron office. I'll add my contact information in the chat. Rabbi Schwartz's book can be available wherever fine books are sold. Also, we have Kodesh Press has been gracious enough to offer a discount to all attendees of tonight's program, a 10% discount off the purchase of the book. I'll include those details in the chat as well. During the program, we just ask that everyone remain muted. If you have any questions, please place them in the chat. And with that, I'll hand it over to you, Rabbi Schwartz. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be involved with Beth Aaron, and the TNET community is our West Side community feeds into TNET very nicely. It's maybe the step on away from West Side, from the West Side to Israel, but we have many Balabatim who were members of our shul 20, 25 years ago who have made their way into your community, and we hope that they continue to be leaders in the communities where they move to, and as we all prepare for our ultimate move to Eretz Yisrael. I would like to leave some time at the end for questions. So how about if we try to go till about 8:30 or so with the presentation, and then I'll leave about 15 minutes at the end for questions. Jesse, does that work? Is that okay?
Sounds great.
Okay, excellent. All right, so there are really two parts to what this book wants to do. At the core, it's a polemic. This was my original point in doing this research, which is about 35 years ago. It was the main theme of a master's thesis I wrote for Dr. Schneer Lyman at Bernard Revel Graduate School. And what I mean by a polemic is that I found over 100 cases in the Vim Rishonim in which there is a violation of the Torah, and there is no reference in the text whatsoever to the fact that there is something wrong. In fact, the point is that if you didn't know Torah law, you wouldn't know that there is a violation. So what makes this a polemic is that this is one of the proofs that the early Bible critics gave to the fact that the early characters of the Bible, the Nevi'im Rishonim characters, didn't know the Torah. Torah was first written at the time of Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and Ezra. So the polemical work that the contribution that this work tries to deliver is the systematic response that has been found in Chazal and the Rishonim. They're worthwhile responses that indicate that the text is not in any way oblivious to the fact that the Torah would normally weigh into these situations. In other words, I'll give a few examples to start with, that the text is not oblivious of Torah law. In fact, the text makes sometimes subtle, sometimes more clear references to the fact that there's something wrong here. Let me be clear. What David did with Bathsheba is not treated in this work because that story says at the end, Vayas hara b'nei Hashem, something is wrong in the eyes of God. So it's very clear to the reader that there's some type of violation, a moral violation or something that explicitly violates something in the Torah. I'll give a few very quick examples. The Torah prohibits us from any peace treaty with the Ammonites and Moabites. The Torah says this in Parshas Ki Tsetse. And David sends a peace treaty to the Ammonites in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud. And the text says that there is nothing wrong with that. The text doesn't notice it. The text doesn't aware that doesn't seem to be aware that there was anything wrong with that. So in this particular case, which is interesting because the rabbis usually go out of their way to absolve David HaMelech from any kind of avera, even much more serious than sending peace to Ammonites. In this particular case, there is a medrash at Tanchum and Parshas Pinchas that says that David definitely sinned in sending the peace treaty to the Ammonites. So why doesn't the text say that Vayas Hara B'nei Hashem, that he erred in violating Lo Tidrosh L'Shlomam V'Tova Samad Olam? So the Medrash says something very interesting, and this is really what an element that pervades the entire work, is that the Medrash says the text did not have to say Vayas Hara B'nei Hashem, because it is evident to the reader that there's something wrong because the peace treaty did not succeed. You know, the story, it's in Shmuel Bet, Perek Yud, chapter 10, that says that the Ammonites very much disrespected the delegation that David sent to the Ammonites, and that led to a war in which David sinned with Bathsheba. So the Medrash says, see, David, you sin a small sin, and that will lead to a snowball into a much bigger thing. In other words, the text didn't have to say Vayas Hara B'nei Hashem because something bad happened afterwards. In fact, in the Bathsheba story, the whole story only says Vayas Hara B'nei Hashem after David feels that he got away with it. It's after the whole cover-up that he sends Uriah to die, and no one in Israel probably ever knew what happened. Right? Some of Rishonim say that if had Avshalom known what David did with Bathsheba, he would have made that the cornerstone of his rebellion, not that the people aren't getting good justice in time. Be that as it may, and certainly, by the way, Adoniyahu would have used that as well in the beginning of Melachim Aleph. The point, though, is that this Medrash is willing to say that it's obvious that David sinned, because the story right afterwards led to the biblical response, which was the disrespect shown to those soldiers, which led to war. Just as a side note, if I may, just a fascinating discussion in the Rishonim, is that the Yeraim is the author of his name was Elazar of Metz, the 13th century, and the book is called Sefer Yeraim, and it's a list of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. And mitzvah number 250, which is the mitzvah not to send peace to the Ammonites and Moabites, he says that in his opinion, David did not sin in sending a peace delegation to the Ammonites. Why not? Because the story begins by saying that David wanted to return a favor that the Ammonite king did for him. The Bible does not tell us what that favor is. Rashi does. Rashi cites a medrash that says that when David sent his family for fear of what Shaul might do to them to live amongst the Moabite king killed all of them except one sibling that the king of Ammon saved. So that was the favor that the Ammonite king did for David. And David returned the favor by sending a peace delegation when that king died for his son. This, says the Yeraim, is the excuse. The Bible didn't have to say there was anything wrong because there wasn't anything wrong. The Torah says, Lo tidrosh l'shlomam, do not seek the peace of Ammonites, but you are allowed to return the peace to the Ammonites. If they seek your peace, you're allowed to respond in kind. You can't, Lo tidrosh l'shlomam, you can't seek their peace, but if they make a first move, you're allowed to respond in kind, says the Yeraim. It's a big chiddush. In the Rambam, in Hilchos Melachim, where the Rambam cites this rule without this caveat, the Kesef Mishnah, right, the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, right, commenting on the Rambam, cites this Yeraim, and he says, I don't know why the Yeraim is so interested in absolving David of sin here. The Tanchuma already agreed that it was a sin. So what is he trying to clear up? So this is going to lead to the second point I want to make, besides the polemic, is that, I don't know, have they done this kol hadam l'kaf schus? You know what I mean? If you can explain something David did more with more justification, it's a mitzvah to do that, isn't it? I'm not saying to be unrealistic. Of course, I must insist, there is a what we call a nafka mina lahalacha. There's a very big difference in the halacha between these two interpretations. Because according to the Rambam, as interpreted by the Kesef Mishnah, we're not allowed to even return a gesture of peace to Ammonites. But according to the Miriam, we are. You get it? It's a different, big difference in halacha. Halacha l'maisa. Okay? So, but understand that at its core, this Medrash is saying that it must have been sinful because look at the bad thing that happened to David afterwards. Now, this may be a moral fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc, right? After this, therefore, because of this, which was the mistake made by Eov's friends to say, if you're suffering, you must be sinful. But that's the way the Midrashim work on this issue, right? I take you to a similar discussion, Aran, in Meseches Chulin, where the Gemara says that Kol Nachash She'eno Ke'eliezer Eved Avraham Eino Nachash. It also mentions Yonason Ben Shaul, but that's not my discussion now. Kol Nachash She'eno Ke'eliezer Eved Avraham Eino Nachash. Divination is defined by what Eliezer did at the well to choose a wife for Yitzchak. The Gemara in Tainus, in the beginning of Tainus, says that Shlosha Shalu Shaloka Hogan, that these three biblical characters made bad deals with God, and it counts Eliezer among them. This was not a smart thing that he did. What if someone not appropriate for Yitzchak would have come and given water there? So the Ran says, however you have to understand this Gemara, we must explain that what Avraham's servant did there was not sinful. Why do we say that? Because look, he got a good response. He got Rivka out of the deal. If what he did was inherently sinful, it wouldn't have been successful in the end. Right? So that is a fascinating approach that Chazal take to this, is that they look at the actions of biblical characters and they can determine whether the action deserves to be justified or not, depending on the reaction in the text itself. Not by saying Vayasara, that God didn't like it or this was sinful. The Bible doesn't always act that way. But the Bible always tells a story afterwards about the relative success or failure of the action based on what happens afterwards. Okay? So why do I call this a polemic? Because the early Bible critics, who were, by the way, guided very much by anti-Semitism, right? The very early Bible critics like Julius Wellhausen, Jean Ostrek, these were people who had an axe to grind against Judaism. It's shameful that so many Jewish scholars just bought right into it. The original claims meant to show that Judaism was not more than 50, 100 years older than Christianity. Of course, this is before archaeology. And we don't have any basis in our Talmudic law, and this is all fabricated. So I think what the contribution that this book makes is that it collects 100 examples of where these critics claim, see, they didn't know the Bible, and it deals with these cases and shows that the Bible was very well known. By the way, if you wanted to go on the offensive here, Nevi'im Rishonim is filled with cases that say that make reference, specific reference to the Torah. Right? After in Sefer Melachim, after an assassination of a king, it says the son became king and he killed all of the men who were involved in the assassination of his father, but he did not kill their children because it says in the Torah of Moshe, do not kill children for the sins of their parents. Right, so what did they do with that? How come someone as early as Yoash knows about the Torah of Moshe if it wasn't written for another 250 years? They take all those cases and say they're anachronistic. Right, that's nonsense. Okay, so I get the polemics out of the way because that's not as interesting as the next part, which is Havedon is kol ha'adam l'kavzchus. This does not mean judge every man favorably. No, that would be Havedon es kol adam l'kavzchus. Havedon es kol ha'adam l'kavzchus means judge the entire person favorably. What does that mean? You can't just look at one act and make a judgment. You have to see the whole bigger picture. Look at the act in terms of other references, maybe in another place that refers to this particular act. Not every person deserves to be judged favorably. Oh boy, we see that very much in Midrashim, right? Esav and Yaakov can do the same thing, only Yaakov is judged favorably and Esav is not. The source of this kind of approach to Midrashim is a famous Gemara in Maseches Shabbos that takes place over almost two pages. It says, starts off with Reuven. Kol ha'omer Reuven chata eino elatoh. Kol ha'omer b'nei Eli chatu eino elatoh. Kol ha'omer b'nei Shmuel chatu eino elatoh. And it goes David and Shlomo. It goes to the whole series of sinners in the Torah and the Nevi'im. And it tells us that although the text in these cases tell us of either that they actually sinned or that they committed egregious sins, somehow the Bible chooses to clear up their sins and say, no, it's not a sin. Now, my work called Conflict and Resolution in the Early Prophets is not out to clear up the reputation of Shmuel's sons or Eli's sons. The text tells us about that, and that's not really in my work. The most popular or common perpetrator in this work is actually David HaMelech. King David seems to take liberties with a lot of the mitzvahs of the Torah with the total acquiescence of the text. He makes his sons to be Kohanim. David wears the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. David sends peace to the Ammonites. David remarries a woman that he was married to who meant to marry another man in between. David is lenient when stringency is called for. He's stringent when leniency is called for. He pronounces a death penalty for someone who steals a sheep. I must tell you that and in none of these cases does the biblical text make any hint that there's something going against the Torah with these actions. So that's really what we're doing next week, categories of perpetrators. But first, let's now talk about the categories of resolutions. Okay, because this study shows that the rabbis of the Talmud were keenly aware of the connection of Torah law to these examples. I'm going to start to give examples of the resolutions. I just wanted to conclude that Gemara in Maseches Shabbos that mentions Reuven, sons of Eli, sons of Shmuel, David, and Shlomo. Let's stop with those five. These five never sinned. David is talking with Bathsheba, Shlomo with respect to all the women he married, Eli with the women that they violated in front of the Ohamoed, Shmuel's sons with accepting bribes, and Reuven by sleeping with Bilha after Rachel died. It's interesting that four of these five involve sexual violations, and only B'nai Shmuel is a monetary violation, but it's neither here nor there. These are all these violations, the Gemara tells us, if you think that these were actually violations, you're mistaken. Now, it's very interesting to look at Rashi's commentary to all five of these, because Rashi goes out of his way to show that Shlomo did not sin with all those women. He converted them. Even the Rambam writes that in Hilchos Ishus. He converted them, and he was just a victim of being trying to outsmart the Talmud and the Pasuk, the Torah that says, don't have too many wives because they'll turn you astray. And he said, no, I'll have many wives. I'll become the son-in-law of every king on earth. I'll bring peace to the land because peace is my name. I'll build a temple, and I will make sure they don't turn my heart astray. But alas, don't try to outsmart the Torah. And yet, Rashi goes out of his way to show that Shlomo didn't sin. But David and Bathsheba, I don't have to tell you. Rashi goes out of his way to show that that's week three, where we talk about two case studies in Sefer Shmuel. One will be the story of Bathsheba. And when it comes to Reuven, Rashi goes out of his way to show that Reuven did not sin with Bilhah. This is very problematic. The text says, Vayishkav es Bilhah, he slept with Bilhah. And yet, the Mefarshim give Reuven a pass, not to say that it's justified to sleep with your father's, it says, Pilegesh Aviv, but earlier in Bereishis, Bilhah was called Eshes Aviv, right? It's called the husband of, the wife of his father. It's not like Rashi says that Reuven was justified in sleeping with Bilhah in order to make sure that his father would pay the proper respect to his mother. Okay, fine. The Gemara says in Megillah and in Masechta Shabbos that Reuven was very hurt that he had to watch his mother play second fiddle to Rachel all those years. And when Rachel died, he said, I will not allow my mother to play second fiddle to Rachel's handmaiden. So after Rachel died, when Yaakov moved in with Bilhah, what can Reuven do to assure that his mother will get the respect she deserves? So in the text, it's he slept with Bilhah and made sure that she wouldn't, that Yaakov would never go near her. In some of the books of the Apocrypha, like the Testament of the 12 Tribes or the Book of Jubilees, we see that they explain Reuven did what it says in the text, right? And even some of the Mefarshim say so. But Rashi was very, very good at excusing our great biblical characters. Rashi says that what Reuven did is not even what's written in the text. It's problematic. I mean, Vayishkav es Bilhah is Vayishkav es Bilhah. But Rashi says that what he actually did was he moved a couch from one place to another. I keep saying Rashi and not Bereishis Rabbah and not Gemara Megillah or Gemara Shabbos because we know what those Midrashim say. And we can give a medrash a pass on those things. Medrash is medrash, and maybe their excuses they don't always mean for themselves to be taken literally. But Rashi is a pshat perish to the Torah. Rashi's job is to tell us what happened, right? Unless maybe it's not to tell us what happened. And maybe Rashi is also coming to tell us sometimes a deeper meaning of the text or something of the sort, right? But be that as it may, the Medrash is willing to give Reuven a pass because he had his mother's respect in mind. So Rashi, I just told you three of the five, goes along with the Gemara. But when it comes to the sons of Eli and the sons of Shmuel, Rashi says they did what the text says they did. Right? They slept with the women in front of the Olmoed and they perverted justice. Look at the Malbim. The Malbim even goes even one step further to try to absolve them, like the Gemara says. But notice, to Rashi, Reuven, David, and Shlomo have a don as kol ha'adam v'kafschus. Those three biblical characters deserve kafschus. B'nei Shmuel, B'nei Eli, not so much. Okay? If you see the way Lot behaves when he invites his company, and the way Avraham behaves when he invites his company, in the same parsha, in Parshas Vayera, right? You see that Lot is just explained in Bereishis Rabbah. He can't do anything right. Lot seems like a pretty decent guy, the way he's taken care of and putting those guests and putting his life on the line, right? And yet Lot is treated very harshly in the Midrashim. And Avraham, of course, can do no wrong. So there, may I suggest to you, I'm going to coin a term. With Lot, it's called Masa Bonim Simon La'avos. You get it? Masa Bonim Simon La'avos. Lot's descendants became Ammon and Moab, our worst enemies. Right? The only two nations on earth that can't convert. Right? The Rambam seems to paskin that even Amalek can convert, but not Ammon and Moab, at least not the males of Ammon and Moab. Right? A male Amaleki can convert. There's even an Amaleki convert in the beginning of Shmuel Bet. But a male Ammonite, Moabite, no. So if Lot's descendants became so wicked, so it must be that they had it in the DNA from Lot. Right? Okay, it could be. So now let's take a look at some of the categories of resolution. Okay? The first two categories are violation resolved or violation explained away. Let me differentiate between those two. The Torah says that a nazir may not approach death defilement. You may not touch a dead body. Yet, the most famous nazir in the whole Bible does nothing but that. That's his CV. That's what he does. He kills Philistines. So the Gemara in Maseches Nazir and Daf Dalet asks, how could a nazir like Shimshon, be so insensitive to his Nazirite law of not becoming death defiled? So the Gemara first suggests, wait a second, look at every story. He seems to always kill a Philistine with either a jawbone. You know, he kills them from a distance. Maybe he throws a rock at them, he shoots something at them. There's no proof that he actually slaps them. Well, there is a story where he kills 30 Philistines to take their garments, in the very first story at his Sheva Brachas, right? So there the Gemara suggests, no, he gave them a good zetz, and they didn't die until a few moments later, right? He gave them a good karate chop, and he had a minute before they died in order to slip off their garments and give them to fulfill the bet that he lost, right? With the honey, you know what I'm talking about? Okay, so that's called resolution, right? Violation resolved, right? We resolved, okay, you're mistaken. You had the Naziris part right, but you didn't have the story right. You thought he was touching the Philistines. No. He never touched Philistines when he killed them. So that's a little hard to digest. I wouldn't have minded even a Horah Shah kind of answer that said, right, Horah Shah means an emergency dispensation. What would that be? Well, since he's trying to save Israelite lives by attacking the Philistines who were killing Israelites at the time, so it was allowed for this nazir to touch dead bodies. Okay, that would be a different type of category, which we'll get to shortly. So that's called violation resolved. However, violation explained away is always a better resolution. And by the way, this may be true in life, right? To resolve a problem is one thing. To explain away a problem, now that's really good negotiation. Because what does the Gemara say right afterwards? If you can't accept that Shimshon never actually touched the Philistines after they were already dead, it was only beforehand, there is a better resolution, which is Nozir Shimshon Mutu Latami Lamesim. Right, the angel that instructed his mother what the child should do, right, explained the law regarding wine, explained the law regarding his hair, but he never said anything about death defilement. Right, that actually is considered one of my violations in this book. I consider it a violation of Nazirite law that when the angel told Shimshon's mother what to do, he left out one of the cardinal rules of not Nazirus. It's the most important one of the rules. It's the one that always breaks the Nazirus. If a Nazir drinks wine, it didn't break his Nazirus. If he cuts his hair, it may, to a certain point. But everybody holds that if he comes to a death defilement, all bets are off. He's finished. He has to start all over. And wait till he becomes purified, right? It's a game breaker. So why doesn't the angel tell his mother about it? So the answer is this violation explained away. And again, there's a nafkamina lahalacha. Okay. At this point, I want to, you should be aware of a particular volume called Nachlas Shimon. It's an excellent, excellent work. I have the full work. It's by a man named Shimon Krasner. I believe he lives in Baltimore. He's still around. And he started this work a good 35, 40 years ago. It was around when I started working on this in 1982. And it's sugyas in Tanakh, like the various stories in Tanakh, and all the halachic ramifications of the stories. I believe that Rav David Cohen had also a book like this called Ohel David, also written in the 70s. And there is also a book that has a green cover. It's called Musar HaNeviim. It's sort of like a Torah Tmima on the Neviim with nice notes at the bottom. So if these are a few of the books you might want to get in Neviim Rishonim to work on this kind of material. And of course, I believe there's a 10% discount on Kodesh Press if you on this book as well. Okay, just one other book of this sort was very interesting. Was written in the 17th century by the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. His name was Menashe ben Israel, and the book is called The Conciliator. The Conciliator. It was written in Portuguese. You can find an English translation probably at some libraries. I know the YU and the Stern Library have it. It's called The Conciliator, and it's written in a few volumes where it has the resolutions of what it considers to be contradictions between the Torah and the Neviim Rishonim, or other places in the Bible. It's much more general than my work, because my work is only about violations of the Torah. His work is about anything, whatever, you know, if it says a certain number in the Torah, and then in Tehillim is a different number, so that'll be an example of a resolution that's necessary. Anyway, that's called The Conciliator. Okay. All right. So far we have two different examples of resolutions. We have violation resolved, right? Violation explained away. Horah Shaa is also a type of violation explained away, but it is sort of a duas ex machina. It's sort of an automatic answer that you can just instill into the story and say, oh yeah, it's okay because it's an emergency dispensation. Now, the words Horah Asha'a literally mean an emergency ruling. So you can't get a Horah Asha'a from just anyone. Horah Asha'a is from someone who can give a Horah, usually a Navi, a prophet, or a king, or something like that. Probably the best work you can find on everything you need to know about Horah Asha'a, besides, of course, under Hay and Encyclopedia Talmudit, would be in volume two of a two-volume work called Kol Sifrei Maharitz Chayos, Tzvi H. Chages, a great scholar and a great Talmud Chacham of the 19th century. He has comments of his can be found at the end of Masechtas, called Maharitz Chayos. And he has, in the second volume, he has a whole chapter on Horah Shaa, which would be you're right, Shimshon did violate the Torah, but it was called for at the time because he had to save Jewish lives. Okay, it's called like Pikuach Nefesh, right? The greatest example of Horah Shaa is what my daughter may use to make the cover of the work. You see, she didn't paint that. She just put it together from a famous painting. Anybody see who the person in the story is here? He's looking at a mountain and calling down fire from the heavens to ignite a sacrifice. The whole story reeks of Horah Shaa because he's bringing a sacrifice. You see the sacrifice is down here, and he's calling down the fire from heavens in Mount Carmel, which is in the north of Israel. At the time he did this, this is categorically forbidden to offer a sacrifice outside of the precincts of the temple. The man is Eliyahu, and the example is Horah Asha'a. Eliyahu was capable of exacting a Horah of this sort, And it was considered allowed because he had a higher ideal in mind, which was to prove that the God of Israel is a true God. Okay, the Haftorah of this coming Shabbos, if it were not Parshas Porah, would be the aftermath of this story, connecting to Moshe spending 40 days and 40 nights without eating or drinking. So did Eliyahu right after this story. So that's resolution number three, which is called Hora'as Sha'ah. Other examples of Hora'as Sha'ah in this work, it's used most commonly for David HaMelech. David gets away with saying things that the Gemara or Meforshim claim was his right as the king because of Hora'as Sha'ah. I must say that this ruling is not only not found in the Torah's chapter of the king, it's not even found where Shaul in chapter 9 of Shmuel Aleph says, "Ze yihye mishpat ha-melech," this will be the rule of the king. And he goes around to say all of the liberties the king will take, but at no point does he say the king will be able to kill you if he wants, if you disobey him. That, at least says the Rambam, is not derived from Shmuel and not derived from the Torah, but is derived from Sefer Yehoshua. Yehoshua, at the end of chapter 1, says that the 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, and Chatzi, Shevi, Menashe, went up to Yehoshua and said, "If anybody disobeys you, if anyone does not follow one of your directives, you send them to us, we'll have them killed." So the Rambam derives from here, the Rambam cites this, it's Yerushalmi and Maseches Sukkah and Sanhedrin and Bavli mentions it in Maseches Megillah and Daf Yud Daled that it's called Moreid B'Malchus, right? Maran Kedushin refers to this, that Uriah could be sent to his death because he was Moreid B'Malchus. The king told him to go home to his wife and he did not. You don't listen to the king, it doesn't matter what it is. The king has an objective. If you don't listen to the king, he has the right to kill you without a trial. Such is the social contract we signed with our kings. That is known as Hora'as Sha'ah. And the king can not only be more stringent with this ruling by saying that the man who stole the sheep, although the man doesn't exist, David thought he did, so it sounds like a violation, that the man who stole the sheep of the poor man in the parable of Nasan Hanavi in Shmuel Bet, Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12, the man who stole the sheep should die, says David. That is Hora'as Sha'ah. Or you can explain like some commentaries, not that he will die, but that he ought to die. Fair enough. Torah speaks that way too. If a man's ox kills a third time, it says, "V'gamba alav you must." Doesn't mean the master will die, it means he ought to die. So too, when David said, "The man who stole that sheep shall die," it means he ought to die, not that he will. But some other commentaries say that it actually means that David had the power to kill a man who steals sheep. Wow, it's the Wild West, okay, because the king has this Hora'as Sha'ah power. And by the way, the king has the power the other direction. Remember when Avshalom sent the woman from Tekoa to speak to David about inviting Avshalom back to Jerusalem, and she told a story about two of her sons. Again, this story doesn't exist. This is fabricated. She told the story of two of her sons where her husband died and all she has left in the world are two sons, and they got into a fight and one son killed the other. And now the family members want to kill and fulfill the rule of blood avenging. And she says, "If they kill my other son, I have no one left." And then David says, "Not one hair of your son's head will be touched." What right do you have to do that? Right? The story doesn't even indicate whether the son killed him with intent or not. In the very least, he has to go to a city of refuge. Right? And yet David commutes the sentence. So, yeah, the Rambam paskins this way too. Not only does the governor and the president have this right, the king has this right as well. The king can take any punishment, malchus, whatever, except the chatas, of course, but malchus or any punishment the person deserves and commute the sentence. Say, no, he does not deserve the death penalty. or he can say he does deserve the death penalty even when he doesn't. So that is known as Hora'as Sha'a, okay? And that's essentially there are only three different types of resolutions where we absolve the perpetrator. Then there are two additional resolutions that I brought down, which either acknowledged the sin or actually ignored the sin. And the work is only from the Chazal. When I say Chazal, I mean Gemaras, Midrashim, Targumim, because there are some violations in the Nevi'im Rishonim that are simply ignored. And I described what I looked through in order to find out that the rabbis didn't comment on it. I had to read through everything that's on that story that exists in the whole world. Right? Whether it's in the Dead Sea Scrolls, whether it's in the Apocrypha, whether it's in Midrashim, every Midrash in the world, even, you know, you could comb through Ginsberg's legends, there's so much you can look through. Right? Okay. An example of violation ignored by Chazal. And whenever I ran up against a brick wall in Chazal, I found resolution in Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. I guess I should call that Chazal, in which case then I never met a brick wall. An example of a violation ignored is where David learns that Shaul is going to kill him in the morning. David is sleeping in the palace with his wife Michal, the king's daughter, and he learns that he's dead in the morning. And he needs some time to escape. So his wife Michal lets him out the window, right? You all know the story? And it says that they have to make some kind of a dummy in bed. You ever go like on a raid in camp and you want the counselor to think that you're still in bed, so you put something in the bed to make it look like you're sleeping there, right? You put something to make it look like it's your head, right? So Michal wanted to buy extra time by making it look like David was still sick in bed. You know, just give him another few hours and then you can come and get him. By that time, David was far away from the palace and safe. When they came in, when she made to make it look like David was in bed, it says, and she took the trophim that were in the room and she put it in the bed to make it look like a person. Trophim? Excuse me? What? Do you know what trophim are? Trophim are avodah zara. Remember they mentioned in Tanakh, it's avodah zara. Right? I mean, if you want to contemplate what Rachel was doing with the trophim. All right, Rashi says she stole them so her father wouldn't worship them. I must say that's good pshat. It is good pshat. They were trying to escape Lavan. Rachel did not want Lavan, her father, to even think that he had a way to find out where they went. Lavan says, Nichashti, they were steeped in Nichush. She didn't want Lavan to use his trophim in order to find out where they were escaping. That's what you use trophim for. To teach you asidos, to teach you things that you don't know about, usually in the ancient world involving fertility. Right? So that's why some commentaries say, Rachel wanted them for herself. But I don't need to go there. She wanted to keep Lavan from using them. But why were they in David's house? And Rachel's before Matan Torah, for goodness sakes. They were still in Chutz Laretz. But this is in the king's palace. What are they doing with Trophim? So I couldn't find any Mefarshim that discuss it. Targum Yonasan translates the Trophim Tzalmanaya. So, okay, that's not much help. But the Radak says that he had a version of the Targum that translated Trophim as barrels, thin barrels of wine or something, right? Okay, have you ever seen Trophim? I've seen them. You can see them in numerous Israeli museums. They're all over Israel. They look like the shape of a human being, and they buried people inside. Okay, they look like coffins, right? It may be that the Tanakh just wants to tell us it was the shape of a human being. Enough said. But it's just like a toham, yeah, oh yeah, take the trophim. Oh yeah, put the trophim in bed. What are the trophim doing in David's bed? Right? This was quite helpful when I couldn't find something for resolution. Targum was often helpful. Right? The Targum to the Torah is Onkelus. The Targum to Nevi'im is Yonasan ben Uziel, a Talmud, the Talmud Muvhak, the Gemara says in Sukkah and Bav Basra, the Talmud Muvhak of Hillel. Hillel's least Talmud was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and his greatest Talmud was Yonasan ben Uziel. So I have to tell you something phenomenal, fascinating, which is that many times in Nevi'im Rishonim, even when the Gemara does say something, Targum Yonasan ben Uziel is very interested in resolving the apparent aveira. I'll give you a quick example. When Shaul was hanged in the town square in Beit Sha'an by the Philistines, it says that the very valor of the people of Yavesh Gilad was on clear display when they risked their lives of the Shaul and his sons in order to bring them back to their ancestral land for burial. It says in the text of Shmuel, they took down the bodies, burnt them, and buried the ashes in the bones in Givat Shaul, right near the central bus station in Yerushalayim. Got that? They took down the bodies, burnt them, and buried the bones in Givat Shaul. That's a violation of the Torah. Torah says that you're supposed to bury the bodies, the guf, not the bones. We don't burn. We don't cremate. So you might say something like, "Or the Horoah Sholek." The Radak says that the bodies had decomposed so terribly that the Philistines were terrible conquerors. They would string up a king for months, and let his body just disintegrate. So they couldn't. The body had so decomposed. They couldn't carry the bodies way down from Beit Shan all the way down to the center of Yerushalayim. Impossible, right? So, as such, they burnt the bodies. Now, in Divrei Hayamim, it says that these valorous men of Givat of Yavesh Gilad took down the bodies, made a burning for them, and carried the bodies to Givat Shaul to bury them there. Hear that again? It changed around the text of Shmuel to say not that they burnt the bodies. You ever hear they made a sreifa? Making a sreifa for a king was a very common thing of respect. You burnt some of his personal effects, his saddle or some other things like that, right? So here is the upshot of Targum, which is that the Targum to the Shmuel Pasuk, get this, this is, hold on to your seats. The Targum to the Shmuel Pasuk is the Aramaic of the Divrei Hayamim Pasuk. Not they burnt the bodies and buried the bones in Givat Shaul. It's the Aramaic of they burnt the bodies, they made a burning for the king and buried the bodies in Jerusalem. Not Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was conquered by David later, but in Givat Shaul. Right? It's fascinating. Another quick example of this is that it says that Shmuel, and David for that matter, wore an ephod bad. Now, the ephod bad in the Torah is the Kohen Gadol, David and Shmuel are not even Kohanim. What are they doing wearing the clothing of a Kohen Gadol? So in Divrei Hayamim, on both of those psukim, it doesn't say ephod bad. It says mi'il boots. Shmuel wore a mi'il boots. What? It says ephod bad. Yeah, but ephod bad is the clothing of a Kohen Gadol. Right? So it looks sinful. But after Targum Yomason gets his Aramaic on it, it's parav. It's not an ephod bad with a capital E, capital Aleph, like what the Kohen Gadol wears. It just means a long coat, a frock, an apron. And wouldn't you know it, the Targum Yonason in both of those psukim is kardut de boots. Kardut means a coat in Aramaic. Kardut de boots. As if though it's commenting on mi'il boots, the Divrei Hayamim version, and not ephod bad, the Shmuel version. Do you see what's happening here? This is a common thing, that the Divrei Hayamim has an agenda. Divrei Hayamim loves to absolve the Averos of anybody descended from David, and apparently Shmuel too. And what happens, so that's a biblical thing. This is my second thesis this evening, which is, have I done this kol ha'adam l'kav zchus? If it's a good person, try to explain the story in a good manner, right? But be careful. We have to be realistic. If you explain things in a way that's not realistic, people will shy away from it. They'll turn away from it. They won't be able to relate to it. If I try to explain everything about Yaakov in nothing but a phenomenally positive fashion, then I run the risk of people feeling, well, I can't. That's the Yaakov can do that. I can't. I'm not Yaakov. Right? Okay. So this last one is called what appears to be violation ignored by the text, but in all I haven't found, except for this one case where the Radak said turned Salmoniah to something like a barrel, I was able to resolve everything where I couldn't find a medrash. The Targum Yonason helped me out. Okay, the Targum Yonason always gave a resolution to the violation. And finally, the only one where I said violation accepted is where the rabbis agreed that David sinned in sending a peace delegation to the Ammonites. And of course, whenever the rabbis accept such a thing, you can almost be sure that you're going to find some Rishon or some Acharon that says that it is... I find a resolution. Okay, in this case, the Araim said it's permitted to return peace to the Ammonites. It's just forbidden to send peace to the Ammonites. Lo tidrosh l'shlomam. Okay, so I hope that I have given a good introduction to what this work is about. At its core, it is an it's a polemical work. It's meant to give a response, a quick, ready response to the 100 or so proofs that biblical critics give to the fact that the Torah was not known at this time. Okay, then you could go on the offensive and show how many times that the Torah is mentioned, B'davka and Sefer Melachim, Sefer Shmuel, right? Sefer Yehoshua, right? There's also is that the David, who is married to Michal, right? He's married to Michal. Then she becomes the wife of another man. And then David takes her back. Torah explicitly does not allow this. Right? The first husband can never take her back. So how does that work? So here too, the rabbis just understood David would never take back a wife that he shouldn't, right? And if he did, the text should have said so. Again, you're going to say, you really, David didn't have a problem with committing adultery and sending the woman's wife, a woman's husband, to die in battle, but now all of a sudden he's worried with Machzik Ushaso, right? So that is, I'm waiting for the third week to discuss that. Okay, the rabbis were very creative in resolving David. David may be the most protected biblical character in the Tanakh. I say even more than Moshe. Okay? Rashi, for instance, draws a thread with a needle through his Perush al HaTorah for a series of particular sins of Moshe, all involving the same infraction. Can anyone think what that is? Rashi keeps through Shmos, through Vayikra, through Bamidbar, and all the way to the end of Devarim. Rashi keeps reminding us of a certain thread that can be woven throughout Moshe's life. And he is so quick to show us, not only, according to what I said in the beginning of this presentation, not only what the sin is and to draw attention to it, but what went wrong in Moshe's life because of that sin. And the sin is one quick English Hebrew word. It's, I'm sorry.
Angry? You got angry?
Anger. Is that what you said? Yes, anger, ka'as. That Moshe is given to anger, bouts of anger. Moshe himself says so in a famous medrash that appears at the end of Maseches Kiddushin in the Tiferes Yisrael, right? The portrait of Moshe, Shneur Lyman's famous article on Moshe admitting that he was morally deficient, but that he used his free will to change his personality. But Moshe was given to bouts of anger. Ramban has a big piece on this in the beginning of Shmos when he kills the Egyptian. And when he breaks the luchos, and when he smashes the rock, and after his sister dies, and, right? When he gets angry with Aaron in Parshas Shmini, and he gets angry with Pinchas in Parshas Matos for the way they prosecuted the battle against Midian, this is Moshe's issue. He has anger issues, right? And Rashi points out at every turn that when Moshe gets angry, he makes some kind of mistake. He's so humble that he admits it all the time, right? So Yaakov is also very protected. Yaakov does some questionable things, right? But it would appear that David, being the ancestor of Mashiach, and David being, you know, the author of Tehillim, I'd say that must be it. When we can't find the words, we turn to David, who speaks for us. So how could a man like this do what's written in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Aleph? Because we don't understand that Perek, says the Gemara. Okay, that's week three already. But next week we'll be discussing the categories of the perpetrators. All right, I gave you a segue now by discussing this about David just now. And I would like to have some questions. I know I said I'd stop a little earlier, but the time just flew right by. Would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes, Camelia?
I was wondering if anybody ever proposed that when David HaMelech tried to make peace with Ammon and Moab, that perhaps there was an uncertainty whether they were really Ammon and Moab.
Okay, let me correct one thing very quickly. It's just Ammon. And while you are correct that in the Talmud, in the fourth parak in Maseches Brachos, there is just such a discussion regarding Ammon, but this is much earlier, remember. You are correct in the fact that later in history, when an Ammonite convert said, I want to join the Kehillah, and Rabbi Gamliel said, you may not, and Rabbi Eliezer said, you may not, Rabbi Yehoshua said, you may, because we don't know we have doubts about who's really Ammon now. But at the time of that story, those doubts were not...
Maybe the uncertainty, you know, was creeping in.
The Ammonites are clearly defined people even after the Churban Beis Hamikdash. The Ammonites were responsible for killing Gedaliah, right? Som Gedaliah after the Churban. Okay, to my knowledge, that's not an answer that appears in that story, but it does appear later. Anyone else? No other questions? That means I covered everything? Regarding the Trafim, why can't they just be statues and they only become of Avodah Zarah? Okay, so is it this? Okay, so.
That's a question, but you have to click on the chat to see it.
Okay, so.
I'm going to read it for you.
Why can't they just be statues and they only become Avodah Zarah if the individual has designed them as such? In the case of Michal, therefore, the just placed regular statues that were not designed as Avodah Zarah in the bed. This is worthwhile a comment as saying that they were barrels. Then the question just becomes, why would the text there then call them Trafim? Call them Tzlamim. Right? Trafim is a very specific, if you look up in a concordance, it's not used often in the Bible. But wherever it is used, right, in Hosea, in Shmuel, and of course in the story of Rachel and in Bereishis, it's Avodah Zarah, right? It was actually quite a, it had two main components. One was for fertility, and one was to tell the future, tell Atidot, tell me something I need to know. And in some time periods, it was very cruel of Avodah Zarah. They would slaughter someone and cut up the body into pieces and put the body into the cavity of the Trafim and try to communicate with the spirits of that recently slaughtered person in order to gain secrets or to learn what they wanted to know, right? This question is certainly from Nathan, is certainly as acceptable as what Targum Yonason writes. It's just that it doesn't explain why the text calls them Trafim. Okay. Anybody else? You also see Ephod, which is coupled with Trafim, being used in non-Avodah Zarah purposes. Yes. So, yes, Ephod and Trafim are indeed by... it's a very difficult pasuk in Hosea. Hosea seems to be speaking with sarcasm. It says, if you keep behaving this way, you will not have a king, you will not have an officer, you will not have an Ephod, and you won't have Trafim. And what? What are you talking about? An Ephod is something I want to have. A king is what I want to have. But I don't want Trafim, right? So he bunches together things that you should miss having with things that we never should have wanted in the first place, right? But I have to tell you that there are prophets that spoke this way sarcastically. Yirmiyahu speaks about times will get so bad, and he refers to different ways that the people would mourn, and listed amongst some of the common ways that Jews mourned was some of the prohibited ways that Jews should never mourn, like ripping out korcha, ripping out their hair, or gashing their skin, or things like that. The Gentiles mourned that way, not us. Okay, but so that's certainly another good comment from Hosea. Okay, anything else? Jesse, do you see anything else that I...
No, I'm looking at. I don't see any other questions at this time.
Okay, great. So next week at the same time, to discuss the categories of perpetrators, we're going to have a lot of fun. Although my work is in the Vim Rishonim, I'm going to discuss some of the characters in the Torah as well. Okay, we're going to do some Yaakov and Esav stuff. We're going to do some Yosef and his brothers. We're going to do some other things like that to learn how the rabbis had certain preconceived notions about how certain characters should be treated and how that manifests itself in this work.
Great. Looking forward to that very much. Thank you again for the shiur. And hopefully everyone can join us next week. I know there's a problem with the discount code for Kodesh Press. They're working on it. They'll have that available hopefully by the next shiur. But feel free to purchase Rabbi Schwartz's book wherever you can get it.
Okay, everybody, be well. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Call to it. Have a good night.